context that needs to be given to our audience. So I asked Jack Howen a little bit about the bike lanes in between our conversations about specific bills that have been introduced.
Yeah, I mean, it's far from the most consequential thing that's happened, that's been passed. It's, you know, not as consequential as, you know, digging up the Ring of Fire and, you know, breaking treaties. But you can't really try to understand Doug Ford or his government without trying to wrap your head around the micromanaging part, including specifically the municipal micromanaging part. The fact is that they do want to redefine what an economy is, redefine what a resource sector is. They do want to do all these big picture things, but they also want to screw with the actual like pedestrian and cyclist and street infrastructure and the actual arrangement of the streets in the immediate perimeter of the legislature and in the streets surrounding. And I feel like until you understand that, like, that to Doug, that is just as important to Doug Ford as anything else, you can't really get a full picture of what he thinks the premier's job is.
So bike lanes in Toronto that cost approximately $27 million to construct were slated for removal for an additional $48 million, but then were held up by a court injunction. Where are we currently on the bike lane removal, and how likely are they to go forward?
So before I get into everything, the government has the trump card, which is the notwithstanding clause. All of the legal challenge is based on the Constitution, the Charter, and the Ford government has shown a willingness to use the what some would call a nuclear button and just say, no, that doesn't apply. We're just going to reintroduce the legislation with the notwithstanding clause. So if the premier decides that this is a really winning issue and he really cares about it, even if it is, you know, totally struck down by the courts, he's going to do that. And his campaign manager, Corey Tenaik, has described it as a big winner. The premier is sometimes described as a numbers guy. And what that means is that he pays a lot of attention to internal polling. And when you know it, a lot of the Ford government's voters don't like bike lanes. So sort of a slam dunk to rub it in the face of the Toronto cycling elite. But yeah, it's as soon as the legislation came through, it was challenged. There is a pretty well-organized cycling mafia in Toronto. They would love me describing them that way. But no, there are a lot of cycling advocates in Toronto, and it was really important to them to launch this constitutional challenge. So essentially the argument is, by ripping out bike lanes along major streets in Toronto, more people will die, more people will become injured, because cyclists won't just migrate to side streets as the Ford government has said that they should. They'll just continue to bike along Bloor Street. It'll just be way more dangerous for them. They back that up with studies from all around the world that show that bike lanes don't really have that much of an impact on traffic flow, which is the whole reason the government introduced it, and that removing them leads to more collisions between cyclists and drivers, and everyone generally has a worse time.
There's an excerpt from a recent episode of Press Progress Sources. Find out more at pressprogress.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next. Broadcasting since 2020, Tech Won't Save Us is an internationalist left-wing tech podcast featuring Paris Marx in St. John's, Newfoundland. On this highlight from a recent episode, Paris welcomes A Physical Education, How I Escape Diet Culture and Gain the Power of Lifting, author Casey Johnston, to discuss why she pared back on social media and made her smartphone dumber. Now, here's Paris.
Hello and welcome to Tech Won't Save Us, made in partnership with The Nation magazine. I'm your host, Paris Marx, and this week my guest is Casey Johnston. Casey is the creator of the She's a Beast newsletter and the author of A Physical Education, How I Escaped Diet Culture and Gained the Power of Lifting. A piece Casey wrote about making a do-it-yourself dumb phone came on my radar recently, and then I started digging in further, reading about some things that she had written about social media use and how she was changing how she used these technologies that so many of us are so dependent on. Now, of course, Casey was someone who had been on my radar for years, going back to when she was writing for The Outline, but I admittedly hadn't read so much of her work on fitness. And as I was digging into these pieces about smartphones and social media, I was fascinated not just by what she was writing about, you know, those issues that are very important to listeners of this show, but also how she was bringing that together with her focus on fitness and health and the kinds of issues she's writing about primarily these days. And so I thought that this would make a really fascinating conversation, because I'm also at a moment where I'm trying to rethink the types of digital services and platforms that I'm using and depending on to try to get off ones that are based in the United States specifically. But, you know, also just thinking more broadly, you know, as I have been approaching this, realizing that maybe I don't need all of these things that I thought I needed before. But then on top of that, because Casey has a new book out, I thought it was an interesting opportunity to bring in some of her broader work and to understand how that shapes her thinking on these digital technologies today. So I think what came out of that was a really interesting conversation that I think you are going to really enjoy as well. And if you do, make sure to leave a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice, or share the show on social media or with any friends or colleagues who you think would learn from it. And if you want to support the work that goes into making Tech Won't Save Us every single week, so we can keep having these critical, in-depth conversations about important issues related to technology and the world around us, you can join supporters like Roland from Bern, Switzerland, Catherine in Los Angeles, Emilith, Alexandrine in Oxford, Alexi from Germany, Mina from Los Angeles, Ray in London, Tom in Paris, and Pedro from Vienna by going to patreon.com/techwontsaveus, where you can become a supporter as well. Thanks so much and enjoy this week's conversation. Casey, welcome to Tech Won't Save Us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I'm really excited to have you on the show. I remember your writing from back in the Outline days and, you know, have like been aware of your transition toward fitness writing, but it was less of something that I was reading. So I hadn't seen so much of it until you kind of really came back on my radar recently with some of the writing that you've been doing around social media and smartphones and dumb phones, I guess. So I want to dig into all this with you. But first, I wanted to ask you about that transition that you did from tech writing into fitness writing. What was that like? And why did you end up making that kind of bigger switch?
It's a good question. I mean, I originally came out of college. My major was science. I was an applied physics major. I went to engineering school. So I started out writing about more so science stuff, although I also did some blogging back in the day, if anyone remembers the unofficial Apple weblog.
I do. That was a Jason Calacanis publication as well, right? If you have any stories about him, I'm happy to hear that as well.
Oh my God. Not any I can tell on this podcast.
Okay.
So I've transitioned from science writing actually into covering gadgets when all of these companies started releasing tablets and smartphones, Android stuff, although lots of non-Android, like the Facebook phone, etc.
Back in the Windows Phone days as well.
Oh, Windows Phone, huge, huge, huge. I remember HTC phones, Palm OS. So they needed somebody to review all those phones. So I stepped into that role. I did that for several years. And at that time, I started working at Wirecutter when I switched away from that. And that had like a sort of tech/health bent. And by that time, I was starting to get into lifting. Another couple of years went by. I started writing my column about lifting weights, Ask a Swole Woman. Then I kind of kept getting these jobs where it was sort of about the overlap of tech and health, or like I sort of brought both of those things to the table. Like when I was working at Outline, that my technical job was future editor, which the nice thing about it was that it was sort of open to interpretation by the editor what future really means. So I ended up covering a lot of health type stuff, especially women's health, things about IVF and IUDs and those kinds of things. And I remember somebody making a comment about the Outline where they were like, "It's surprisingly strong on women's health issues of all things." And I was like, thank you. That led me a little further down the health path. And it was like the longer I did this column, the bigger a part of my like professional world it came, until I was just sort of taking the feedback that I was getting from the world, which was that was like a thing that people really liked and felt they needed and responded to. So that just sort of grew the longer that I did it. And I think that people appreciated, honestly, that, you know, in a world when things move so fast and you get people who emerge on the scene and they get really popular really quickly and then they take on all the sponsorships and then they sort of like crash out in terms of trustworthiness, that I'm just sort of there like plugging along in my steady way. And eventually, before you know it, you've been doing it for almost 10 years and everyone's like, "Hey, I guess we can trust this person because she's been in it for a long time," but without like betraying the expectations that we might have had. And so I really value that as well, that I've sort of like gained trust over this long time, and I don't take that lightly, I guess I would say.
Yeah, and I feel like that trust is so important these days as well, right? Because there are so many people trying to sell you something that, you know, if you find somebody who you can really trust, who you feel are not just, you know, kind of trying to sell you some fitness product or some supplement because they're making money on the other side of it, then they're going to stick with you because they appreciate the advice that you're getting. Before we talk a bit more about fitness and the types of things you've been doing now, of course, one of the things that I remember you from is kind of leading the charge against Apple's butterfly keyboard that was on the Macs back in the day. You know, Apple launched it as this new keyboard that was going to be so much better, but, you know, a lot of people ended up having a lot of issues with it. And it was your piece that, you know, I think really like encapsulated this for a lot of people. Can you talk about what that was like? And I'm sure Apple was kind of pissed off at you, I would imagine.
It's funny that this comes up because it's like, I've never been busier in my life than in this last week. And then in the last week, also all of these sort of large and small disasters are happening. And one of them was that I opened my laptop in the airport a couple of days ago and the L key was like doing the thing where I was pushing it and nothing's coming out. So the similar issue to the butterfly keyboards. But anyway, yeah, it was really crazy. I mean, the thing that it's hard to remember stuff like that. It's hard to develop a sense of what the context was in which that piece came out, which is like the really important part of it, because people were having problems with these keyboards. Apple knew it because they had a whole, as I described in the piece, a whole lengthy protocol for what to do with somebody when they came in with one of these keyboards. They had like a bunch of tests set up. They would not replace the computer until you had been in three times or something like that for the same issue. So they were aware of it and people were aware of it, but there was a lot of equivocating about it in the media where no one was saying like, this is a bad product. They were trying to like work around it with, well, Apple says, focusing on what Apple's messaging about it was versus just sort of, I mean, it's interesting because this is what I get into in my book that just came out where it's like this idea of like believing yourself in your experience versus what other people are receiving the instructional messaging from the world on what you're supposed to be doing. It's very difficult to say like, no, I think this is a bad product when there's so much, not only Apple is saying, no, it isn't. And there's all of these sort of tech journalists who are saying, no, it isn't. And I was like, I have to sort of believe my own reality here. So I wrote that piece and I think it was controversial at the time. I was able to get some information on the back end from like one institutional customer of Apple, let's say, on the repair rate of these computers at one point. So that sort of spoke to like how endemic the problem was. I mean, actually, I know that Apple PR is legendary for being very communicative on the back end. They used to have one extremely scary like head of PR who would be up in people's faces a lot. She hasn't worked there in a long time. And I think whoever replaced her is not like that anymore. I never heard from Apple directly. I did obviously reach out to their PR address and say like, hey, anything to say about this issue? No response. I've not communicated with Apple PR much. I was not the Apple person at any of my tech jobs. They sort of have point people usually who do the Apple coverage and they will have a greater correspondence with Apple. But Apple's not given me the time of day, which is fine. You know, I'm okay with that.
Totally. You don't need it. Right. And this is why people trust you, because you're willing to call it out when so many other people were like equivocating around it and just willing to say what so many people were experiencing. Just as a final question about this period, how did you find working in tech journalism? And, you know, do you have any reflections on what that industry is like today?
Yeah, it's been through a lot. I mean, all journalism has. I think I was lucky to be in this time when it was sort of shifting away from a more enthusiast press to being more skeptical and more sort of antagonistic, or at least skeptical, maybe is a better word. And now these companies have never had more powerful. Like they were not a tenth as powerful when I started writing about them as they are now. And it's kind of scary how quickly the amount of wealth has metastasized in this industry. There's not remotely enough resources now, I feel like, to cover them to the degree that they need to be. And in a lot of cases, it's like, again, the products are realistically quite bad, quite predatory of people. They have a very deliberate product roadmap of how these things will transform. They pretend they don't understand how algorithms work or whatever, but they know. Like the story that just came out about Google is effectively aware of how bad its search product is now, but it enhances the appeal. Like the fact that search results are so bad enhances the appeal of the sponsored results. So they're like, we're fine with it. I don't think, you know, don't quote me. They're not literally saying this, but the idea is that they are not incentivized to improve the free results because it complements their bottom line for the paid results to appear better than ever.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Tech Won't Save Us with Paris Marks. Find it wherever you get your podcasts at techwontsave.us and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, broadcasting since 2014, Vancouver-based Seriously Wrong is a bi-weekly utopian leftist comedy podcast featuring co-hosts Aaron and Sean and guests in conversations exploring themes like rent strikes, the justice system, airplane food, and more. Like on this excerpt from a special recent supporters-only episode examining how people who believe that drinking urine is a true universal remedy for all diseases and disorders are incorrect. Now, here's the show.
Warning to everybody listening, this is just a teaser. The full episode is available on our Patreon at patreon.com/seriouslywrong. There's a whole bunch of bonus episodes on there, and there are even free bonus episodes on there. With just $6 a month, you can unlock our entire archive, all of our bonus episodes, including this episode. So here is a little taste for you all of urine therapy.
When I do the solo hero's journey on the mountain and I'm peaking, I will usually consume my own living waters and it actually tastes like slightly sweet distilled water. Can you please explain the practice called Shivambu?
Locking in, tuning to the deepest current.
This is going to be subject matter that might trigger some people, but we're going to be talking about liquid plasma, golden plasma.
I wanted to share with everyone a very amazing cure for healing any health issue that you have mentally and physically, and that is urine therapy.
Well, it turns out it's one of the biggest cons in history that urine is dangerous or dirty or a problem.
Yeah. When re-ingested, the senses in your tongue send signals to the body as a bio loopback feed to go, hey guys, it's coming back in. It has the highest electronegative and 3,000 other benefits.
Urine is over 3,000 chemicals in it that our body produces every day. Chemicals in the sense is not a bad thing, like potassium is a chemical.
With stem cells, HGH, polypeptides,
estrogen, testosterone, dopamine,
enzymes,
vitamin C, vitamin
magnesium,
B12, vitamin
phosphorus,
B6,
iron, boron, you name it, it's all in it.
So urine is structured water, and it's structured by your kidneys, for you.
Ultrafiltrated through the discombobulated tubule to tiny millions of units called nephrons.
I'm sure someone is already listening going, what is she talking about?
So yeah, you may be thinking, oh, this is disgusting.
But we've been duped to think that the plasma ultrafiltrate, which is the medical term for urine, is a waste product. And it's right. Not, it's so farther than the truth because I use it as my sunscreen and I'm glowing and glistening.
Your skin will love it. And you won't smell funny. That's the other thing. You won't smell. It absorbs into the skin. There's no problem.
Providing the largest organ of my body, which is your skin, with what I call a liquid love shower, in through my nose, so it sends electricity back to the brain.
We're at a pivotal jumping off point with Shivambu and urine therapy around the planet, leading up to the Water of Life Symposium in Las Vegas. We're not playing small anymore, and we're not just going to hide out online. We're creating a whole world of sovereign spiritual beings that woke up.
This is deeper than you guys think it is, than I think it is, than I can perceive it to be.
The fact that this liquid is you.
The elixir of life was never external. It's been flowing through you the entire time.
This is divine work we're doing here, cleaning out our bodies.
It's like drinking liquid light codes, the distilled essence of your own awakening.
When you tap into the magical waters that you have in thyself, you protect your sacred energy.
To further the work of Shiva. Shivambu God.
Drink of yourself and remember you are the river, the source, and the return. Mic drop.
I just want to be clear for people that are watching, maybe aren't following, we are talking about urine and consuming it.
One, two, three,
Maybe something's wrong.
You're dead wrong.
Woke up this morning knowing I was right.
What's up, Filtration Nation, and welcome back to the Seriously Wrong podcast.
We're here this week siphoning nutrients from the blood, creating an elixir.
Yeah. So welcome to the Golden Zone. Take a seat, enjoy a warm cup of healing elixir, the spiritual river that runs through us. Just like drinking your own urine, the Seriously Wrong podcast is an ancient practice founded in 2014. And the nourishing rivers.
What if it actually came from before 2014? Like, it wasn't a podcast before this, but people have been doing Seriously Wrong.
Right. Yeah. Since time immemorial.
Since time immemorial. It's been happening in one form or another.
Yeah. We have to explore this further. I think it is true that there's some sort of immortal proto Seriously Wrong conditions
history
have been bubbling
back
through. Yeah, yeah. You know, this is the fullest
of
actualization of it. But.
Yeah. And just because it builds on all that's come before, just as what comes next will build on this in whatever form it takes. We don't know yet, obviously. But yeah, we can see into all possible universes and futures except for the actual future of the one universe that we're in. It's the one that's a mystery to us.
Yeah, just like any shaman who goes on individual quests to the mountains drinking their own urine. We're capable of seeing many futures.
Yeah, the peak moment, sort of when the peak energies are thrumming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When your peak energies are thrumming, when you're going on some sort of like singular quest, when you're self-actualizing and so on.
Yeah, that's when you want to drink your own urine.
The midstream.
Yeah, midstream, or if you're looping, you want to do all of it, obviously.
Yeah, so people actually do drink their own piss every day around the world, and that was something that we thought was interesting, so we were kind of talking about that. Maybe we'll talk about people who drink their own piss on the show sometime. It's something that we, you know, we've been saying that for years. That's actually been an ancient tradition in the Seriously Wrong podcast as well. Maybe we'll do a show about drinking. It's kind of like a spiritual, like, wellness thing, and they argue that it's been done around the world in different cultures. They cite like an ancient Indian tantra practice. They say that you should drink the midstream, not the start and the end of your pee, but the middle of your morning pee is best, they say. Some of them
the top information at the top. This is
like we gotta fill people in on what these people say.
Yeah, it's funny, we have been talking about this for the past few days getting ready, and the amount of times the word elixir comes up is really remarkable.
Yeah, like, the urine drinking community has a really highfalutin rhetorical architecture. Like, because it's gross to drink your own pee, they have to like overcompensate by being like, this is your body's perfect medicine. This is the golden fountain of a healing elixir.
There's this book from 1944, kind of like a seminal text, you could say, in the urine therapy community, called The Water of Life.
The one that I read a decent chunk of in preparation was The Golden Fountain, The Complete Guide to Urine Therapy.
The Golden Fountain.
The first chapter is called Getting the Taste, An Introduction to Urine Therapy. They're just diving right in to the taste problem. Let's be honest. The taste issue in the urine drinking community.
I think it is a real issue. You see it come up a lot. A lot of people don't like the taste. They're like, you know, I have trouble drinking more. People will say to start slow and increase until you kind of get more used to it. You'll start to notice the benefits. You'll start to crave it. I don't know if I've ever seen anyone say that.
You're going to start to crave it?
Yeah.
No, it's pretty extreme, you know, medical claims that they're making here. And some of them are quite passionate about it. They're clearly real people as well.
Yeah, many of them. And, you know, it's pretty par for the course for a lot of alternative therapy that, like, kind of fixes everything, helpful with this, helpful with that. But it's just inherently one of the funnier ones because you're drinking your own pee.
Yeah. And as of this recording, there exists no evidence that drinking your own urine has any medical benefit.
At least not compared to other alternatives that may be better.
Right, yeah, to be totally fair-minded.
You know, we can get into it, but there are sometimes when people want to shut down the urine therapy community, and I understand why, like alternative medicine is peddling fake cures to desperate people, and it's like, it's not good that people get tricked into thinking that this is going to fix their medical problems. But, you know, sometimes people make statements that are a little bit over the top about how bad, how dangerous.
So let's get to the real bottom of drinking urine. You know, there's people out there, their loved ones are coming home. They're saying, I'm drinking urine. We should all start drinking urine. And we need to make sure that people have the tools to address that situation in a fair-minded way. With a harm reduction lens.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you're trying to talk your aunt out of drinking her own urine, and you say something that's not fully factually true, and she gets you with, like, a study. Well, actually, you're in this.
Right.
Then
they've got their own links. They've got their own.
You've lost forever.
Groups. Yeah.
Yeah. You want the real facts.
Let's get bulletproof.
Welcome to the show. Yeah.
We now go to a universe where everyone drinks urine all the time, but otherwise everything else is normal and familiar to us.
Oh, hey. Hey, how's it going?
Oh, I'm doing good, man. Thanks for asking. Mm. How you been?
Just thirsty, but other than that, totally fine.
How are the kids?
Kids are great. Doing so good. They're just growing so fast.
Enjoy it. They grow up so fast. It's... Do you see, there's that new movie coming out? I think it's like the second one.
It's the second one, but it takes place in the middle of the first one.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. And I love that director.
And that was a universe where everybody drinks pee all the time, but everything else is normal and familiar to us. Now back to the show.
Was a highlight from a new episode of Seriously Wrong. Find new episodes of the internationally acclaimed utopian leftist comedy show at seriouslywrong.com, at harbingermedianetwork.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 31 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. And by Alberta Advantage. Find out more about Calgary's number one podcast at albertaadvantagepod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now on Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. See you back here next week for a new episode. Until then, I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.